Hello, everybody, and welcome to Shannon Q. I am Shannon Q, and I'm very excited to have you here today. We are going to talk about philosophy of mind, which is one of my favorite topics to discuss, but I only ever really get to discuss it with apologists. So I'm very excited to have somebody here today to talk to me who is not an apologist, who is going to have a conversation with me and deal with some of my objections and introduce me and the audience more broadly into more of the philosophy of mind. So today I would very much like to introduce you to somebody I've been following for a very, very long time and more people should follow. This is Emerson Green. Emerson, tell the people who you are and where they can find you.
Well, I have a YouTube channel. It's just my name, Emerson Green, and I have two podcasts. One is called Counter Apologetics, and the other is called Walden Pod. But yeah, I mean, thanks for having me on. It's very nice to be here.
Well, I'm stoked to have you here. We were chatting just before the show about how I feel as though so much of the conversation in this community is surrounded about, like, revolves around the paradigm of counter apologetics. So we don't get to do as much exploration of the topic of consciousness. And it's something that I've always had an interest in. And it's one of the reasons that I follow you, that and philosophy more broadly. I find that you make it a little bit more accessible. And I think philosophy in general is something that a lot of people in the community have like a passing interest in, but find it not as accessible as they could. So I'm hoping that we can kind of help change that today in our conversation so that people can see that it's, you know, for everybody. So thank you for joining me. I'm super stoked.
Philosophy, analytic philosophy that's happening now can be kind of intimidating because what happens is you just have, you know, really intelligent people writing about a certain topic and then really intelligent people respond to those people and it goes back and forth. And like pretty quickly you have an extremely technical literature that's generated. So a lot of my podcast is just kind of me thinking out loud and trying to figure stuff out. I'm not like issuing. It's like, oh, I've done the philosophy, everybody, you know, time to internalize my conclusions. It's like, I kind of, I'm just exploring. And I, you know, with this topic specifically with like consciousness and philosophy of mind, I don't like really dogmatically hold to any view. Like I explore a lot of possibilities and like I have a couple favorite views. But yeah, I've also pretty much always been interested in philosophy of mind because one of my intros to this whole topic, you know, was Sam Harris. Mm-hmm. And he talks about free will. That's philosophy of mind. He talks about, you know, the hard problem. And he kind of directed me to like Thomas Nagel and David Chalmers. And but yeah, I mean, I guess it started mostly with Sam Harris. And I largely still agree with a lot of the things that he said, you know, way back when I was first getting into it.
Yeah. And I think you do a really, really great job of having broader conversations with people who don't necessarily believe in you, like the same view, like the philosophical view that you hold. I'm not even 100% entirely sure. I feel like you lean panpsychism. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong about that?
Oh yeah. No, that's one of my, that's something that I lean in favor of, but I'm also pretty sympathetic to substance dualism.
Yeah. And I read Philip Joff's book. And I don't know if I can follow that, but we'll get into that in a second. Before we started the show, I was telling you that I don't know exactly where I land philosophically, but I know that most of the things that I've heard people discuss, like when it comes to monism or substance dualism or panpsychism, most of what I come up with are like objections that I feel like I have, like things that I feel like are like my linchpin. Like the one of the videos that I recently watched, you were talking to an atheist who's a substance dualist, or a dualist at least. I probably shouldn't say substance dualism.
He's a substance dualist.
Is he a substance dualist? Okay. It's been a while since I watched it, but the interaction problem when it comes to substance dualism is an issue for me. And when it comes to panpsychism, the problem of it, like coalescence, is an issue for me. So I'm not even sure where to start with you because I feel as though there's so much ground to cover. But I don't even know where to go. We both can probably agree that there's not a soul in the Christian conceptualization of a soul. And we're talking about very sophisticated things today. So I grabbed wine because we're talking about sophisticated things.
I'm trying not to drink so much. I think I'm going to take a break from drinking for 20 years or so, and then
20 years. Well, I mean, we'll taking see. A break from drinking is a good thing. There's not, there's nothing wrong with taking a break from drinking. I'm not, because I already poured this glass of wine. Because
we're talking. Yeah, well, you have to finish it if you poured it. But
I have to. Why would I waste a good Valpolicella?
Once I have kids and they're grown up, I'm just gonna get smashed every day because
So yeah, when it comes to the soul, I'm not even sure where to start. I guess we could. Or with the soul, sorry, geez. I'm so used to doing counter apologetics. When it comes to consciousness, I'm just not even sure where to start. I guess I can start with kind of explaining why I don't even hold a position. I feel as though, like I said, dualism has an interaction problem. Panpsychism has a problem with, like, basically, like, why aren't rocks conscious? I mean, that's a super, like, simple breakdown of my objection. So maybe start with why it is that you adhere to panpsychism and what panpsychism is. Cause I don't think many people are super familiar with panpsychism in the broadest of terms.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I lean in favor of panpsychism. I'm not, like, you know, absolutely sure it's true or even, like, overwhelmingly sure it's true. I just kind of, I mean, the thing is, it's actually very similar to physicalism. Like, some people think it is just a form of physicalism, which I agree with, but, you know, if you're having a conversation with someone and you think that, you know, consciousness is fundamental, and you call yourself a physicalist, you're mostly just going to confuse that person. It's not, like, very clear. So I call myself a non-physicalist. But panpsychism, I mean, it's helpful just to start with physicalism. And then you say, okay, well, think about what you were already thinking with physicalism. And it's just the intrinsic nature of physical activity is consciousness. So, you know, you can sort of roughly describe physicalism as, like, well, you know, consciousness is just the brain. Like, there's nothing over and above these physical brain states. And that's just what consciousness is. And panpsychists take that, you know, very seriously. And they just think that, you know, sort of the way that we see consciousness as sort of like the inner nature of the brain, maybe, or like, you know, there's the brain on the one hand and consciousness on the other, but they're, it's just one substance there. Panpsychists don't draw any kind of arbitrary cutoff, you know, in the physical world, where they just say, like, yeah, that just is physical material. Like, that just is physical activity. The arguments for panpsychism kind of span, you know, a few different, I mean, I feel like I should back up a step before I start talking about arguments like for physicalism or for panpsychism. When we talk about consciousness in, like, the metaphysics of consciousness, there's actually pretty much a consensus about what we're talking about, which is, like, you know, kind of rare in philosophy when you have, like, widespread agreement, you know, especially between philosophers and scientists, and, like, pretty much everyone agrees that what we're talking about is phenomenal consciousness. Like, that's the thing that we're trying to explain. Like, when
what do you mean by phenomenal consciousness for people who aren't, like, keep in mind, people like me, morons, like I am, aren't gonna, like, pick up on the technical jargon. So
yeah. Well, you're not a moron, but phenomenal consciousness is it's just roughly, you know, it's just experience. So, if you think about Thomas Nagel's famous definition, when he talks about what is it like to be a bat, you can talk about, well, bats, you know, they have some faculties that we don't have, you know, they echolocate, and, you know, we don't really know what it's like to echolocate. We don't know what it's like to be a bat, but surely it's like something to be a bat. And that is sort of what we're talking about minimally when we're talking about phenomenal consciousness. It's like subjectivity, just the fact that it's like something for you to exist, but presumably it's not like anything for this table to exist. So if I stick a knife in my leg, that will feel like something. If I stick a knife in a rabbit, you know, it will feel like something for that rabbit. But if I stick a knife in the table, it won't feel like anything. Okay. So that sort of what it's like is what we're honing in on. And phenomenal consciousness is supposed to have some of these other attributes as well. Like, it's supposed to be private, as in not publicly observable. So this is, like, what generates the problem of other minds, when you can even, like, wonder about solipsism, like, oh, well, maybe I'm the only mind that exists, you know, maybe all these other beings out there are just kind of physical machines that don't have any feelings. So, you know, the reason you can even wonder about that is because phenomenal consciousness is private. It's not publicly accessible to anyone who wants to see it. So phenomenal consciousness is, you know, subjective, it's private, and there are a few other attributes that people talk about, but I mostly care about subjectivity and privacy. I feel like those are maybe some hints that it's not physical, but I don't want to get ahead of myself. But people do generally agree, like, that's what we're talking about, you know? Like, it's not like a big mystery. Oh, what is consciousness? It's like, well, you know what consciousness is. You're conscious. Like, it's actually the thing you know best. You know, like everything.
Yeah, there's something that it's about. Like to be you. Like, yeah. You know, like Descartes, you know, mm-hmm. I think therefore I am. Like, you know that you exist. That's a thing that you can know of potentially, the like, depending on how far you drill down. Maybe even the only thing you could know is that you exist and are having experiences.
Yeah, and with total certainty, it seems like that's the only thing you could know. Yeah. Okay. But with Descartes, I don't know if I'm maybe more sympathetic to like eliminating the self, like the I, you know, that's there. You know, like, I'm not sure that the self in like a really robust sense exists in the way that Descartes talks about, but certainly like consciousness exists. And everything you know, like the entire world comes to you through consciousness. It's like the thing you know best. So, you know, Galen Strawson has this kind of funny article in the New York Times where he's like, you know, there are all these like verifiably intelligent people saying that consciousness is a big mystery. He's like, it's really the only thing that's not a mystery. If you think about it, it's like the only thing you really know. He's like, the physical, on the other hand, is mysterious. Like, we don't know the true nature of the physical, but again, kind of getting ahead of myself, but I mean, I'm sure that most of the people in your audience have heard of the hard problem of consciousness.
Yeah. I've thrown my audience chance probably.
Yeah.
That they have, like, why is it that there is something that it is like.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, we're talking about subjectivity, you know, phenomenal consciousness. And the hard problem is just like, okay, why is it like something to be a brain? Like, there's just this wet mass of tissue that has some electricity running through it. And it's like this, you know, like that's pretty wild. So, you know, I mean, the hard problem is meant to sort of illustrate that there's at least an epistemic gap between the physical and phenomenal properties. Like, you know, I'll just put it in like a really technical sense and then I'll say it in plain language, but it's just really meant to illustrate that phenomenal properties don't logically supervene on brain states. So there's not like an a priori conceptual entailment from physical properties to phenomenal properties. And really all that means is like, you can describe the brain state, but like in as much detail as you want. You know, you right. can really drill down like to the neuronal level or like the more macroscopic level or whatever. You can mm-hmm. always ask the question, why is it like something to be all that stuff there? Like, you know, because it doesn't seem to follow for free, I guess. Like if you, there's this article that's kind of intended to mock non-physicalists like me called The Hard Problem of Breakfast. where it says like, oh yeah, I understand that there's orange juice and there's coffee. That's a hilariously huge cup you have. It's distracting, sorry.
I drink water out of this all day. I'm really sorry. Yeah, aside from the wine, I drink a lot of water. Yeah.
So they're like, oh yeah, I see that there's bacon and eggs on the table, I see that there's orange juice and coffee, but where's the breakfastiness, you know, where's the, you know, the ineffable breakfastness that, you know, emerges from this? And, you know, it's just making fun of people who think there's a real hard problem. But I actually really like that article because it like perfectly illustrates how it should work if physicalism is true, where, yeah, there is no hard problem of breakfast. You just describe all the component parts of breakfast and they stand in a certain relation to each other. And breakfast just comes for free. Like breakfast just kind of naturally supervenes on all that stuff. It just like, there's no mystery as to how you get breakfast out of the right combination of all that stuff. Like in the same way that if you have people kind of dancing and drinking, then you have a party. The party just comes for free. You know, there's no hard problem of partiness or hard problem of breakfast. Or if I describe like a flower, like it has a stem and roots and flower petals, and I describe the right arrangement of those things, and it just comes for free that there's a flower, you know, like it's just entailed. But like when I describe complicated brain states, it does not come for free that there are phenomenal properties, you know, that it's like something to be that electrified tissue. So that's why there's a hard problem. And that doesn't mean, oh, you have to abandon physicalism now. All that shows really is that there's an epistemic gap between the physical and phenomenal properties, which, you know, factors into a lot of arguments against physicalism. But, you know, if you're a physicalist, you're not doomed just because you think there's an epistemic gap. Like most physicalists grant, yeah, of course there's an epistemic gap. There's a few who don't, but that's been largely unpopular since like the 1980s and 90s for reasons we can get into.
Well, I've often wondered, like, I feel like I'm probably not being familiar with the like the ins and outs of the philosophy, like, but I feel like if I needed to be defined, and I'm not sure that I need to, but if I needed to be, I think I would be a physicalist who thinks that consciousness is kind of an emergent property of the brain, but can't explain why. Like, I can't explain why. And I've often struggled with the like feeling like within philosophical discussions about consciousness, it feels like there's this paradigm that already exists where it seems as though everybody's already had proposed all of the potential theories about this. And you need to align with one of them or you're not thinking about it deeply enough. And I don't know if I do, because I don't feel like any of them are satisfactory. What does somebody like me do in that instance? Because I'll expand a little bit further with like a couple of my like objections more broadly explained. So people who are familiar with me, who have heard me interact on like, you know, calls and in conversations and just in general, have heard me talk about like sodium ion transmission like at the neuronal level, right? And like, so I find that a deep problem when it comes to interaction, because in order for me to have a thought at all, a series of very physical, predictable events need to occur that we would be able to see. So like we would need sodium and potassium ions to reach a specific threshold. We would need mitochondrial cells within the neuron to release ATP to open a channel so that they could pass back and forth between either side of that cell membrane to create the action potential for that neuron to like create the electrical impulse that allows like a neurotransmitter to be released, like transferring down the axon and all the way to the synapse to communicate. Like all of that is like very clearly laid out for me. I understand that component of it. So I know that that is the case. Like that is demonstrably the case, and that is demonstrably like observable. And most philosophy that I hear is functionally kind of saying, especially with dualism, that, you know, something can control that. Like something can have an influence on that. And that doesn't seem plausible to me. Like I wouldn't know how, I wouldn't know by which mechanism. I feel like it would be observable if that was the case, because we would have a deterministic state where a neuron was about to fire and then something would have to intervene if that neuron shouldn't fire based on like some outside influence. If some sort of dualism was the case, in my objection, I'll start with that objection and then I'll go to my panpsych objections later. That's probably already enough. So like, how do you feel like that's a legitimate objection? And you're allowed to say no. Tell me why. I want to learn more stuff. I want to be right. So I want to know.
Yeah, no, I mean, just on your first point of like, what do you call yourself? It's like,
I have no idea.
What you described is actually my third favorite position, kind of, okay. Which is called Mysterianism. Oh. So Colin McGinn says pretty much exactly what you just said, where he's like, well, I think consciousness must be physical, but we just can't see how it could be. Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like that's roughly what you were saying. So
yeah,
he defends this position that's sort of like defended by Noam Chomsky in some settings, it seems like. Chomsky sounds like a dualist sometimes, and other times he sounds like a Mysterian. But a Mysterian basically believes that we're like golden retrievers trying to understand general relativity. Like,
that sounds about right, yeah.
That's how I feel about a lot of subjects with me, actually. But they're saying like humans just can't, like as a species, like we just can't do it. We can't understand how to answer the hard problem of consciousness. And you know, Chomsky makes kind of like an evolutionary argument for it. Like Colin McGinn makes a slightly different argument for it. But, you know, if you're not really satisfied with like any of the options, then that seems like a pretty good, I mean, that seems, you know, like you can make arguments for that position if you find yourself not terribly satisfied with any of the options. Another thing you said, though, you mentioned emergence. And so like emergence, I like the distinction between strong emergence and weak emergence.
Okay.
So you're talking about like weak emergence, right?
I don't know. Tell me what the differentiation is.
Okay. So like in his book, The Big Picture, Sean Carroll makes this distinction which I think is super useful, where weak emergence is sort of like when I was describing earlier, the stuff that you get for free, you know, mm-hmm. like the flower kind of emerges from the right component parts in the right structural arrangement, you know, or like breakfast comes for free when you just have the component parts in the right relation to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's like weak emergence, you know, it just follows kind of trivially from like just putting stuff together in the right way. So like atoms are not square, but this table that's made of atoms is square. So you can get like square things out of non-square things, you know, so that's like an example of weak emergence. Strong emergence is like when the whole is genuinely something over and above its parts. So like there's not this like intelligible reduction from the whole to the parts. Like it doesn't come for free. There's some additional thing that you like couldn't have predicted from knowledge of the lower level entities or properties or states of affairs. So that's like a much stronger form of emergence. And in philosophy and metaphysics, that's just called emergence. That's like strong emergence is kind of redundant. But I've noticed that a lot of physicalists will say, oh yeah, I believe consciousness emerges, but they obviously don't mean it in that stronger sense because they wouldn't really be physicalists at that point. They would probably more likely be property dualists.
So like a way that I've thought of it, like as a non-philosopher who just thinks about things without using philosophical terms, it's like, so you can see my guitar behind me, right? So that's one of my guitars. So that guitar is not music. But if I strum the guitar, it will generate, well, if I'm doing it right, it'll generate at least sound, right?
Yeah.
So there's a differentiation between the two. That guitar is not sound. It is not music, but there can be a certain state of affairs where I interact with it that it generates music. Like the music is dependent upon it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And dependent on like how it's engaged with.
Right.
And I feel that's kind of how I feel about consciousness. Like there needs to be the guitar in order for the music to exist, and it needs to be interacted with in a specific way. It needs to not be missing parts. Like the back needs to be on it. It needs to have strings. Like it needs to have a certain configuration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, so I mean,
that's how I feel about it. Does that make sense? Like it does that transmit?
It does. Yeah. I mean, but so that's how you explain consciousness roughly.
Vaguely. Yeah. That's how I conceptualize it anyway, is that I have a brain and I know that a certain state of affairs needs to exist. Like I need to be able to like breathe in and breathe out and have blood circulate to it. It needs to have electrical impulses. And in that state of affairs, it can generate something that is called consciousness. If something about it, like if I die, if there's something that prevents it from being in that configuration, then consciousness demonstrably, I think, I mean, you could posit that maybe you're still conscious and you're just like off in the ether or whatever the fuck, but I don't like, that doesn't make sense to me. Like that seems like just a posit that's like an assertion that's not founded on anything, because we know when people die, we can't interact with them anymore. That's like demonstrably the case.
Yeah.
So that's the way I see it. Like without that specific configuration of these specific components, we don't get consciousness.
I see.
I don't know why, but I know that that is the case.
Okay, I see. So, I mean, it's kind of, on the one hand, it sounds a little bit like you're endorsing the kind of physicalism where there shouldn't really be a hard problem, like, because there's no epistemic gap between like music and like, you know, an instrument that plays the music. Like there's no hard problem of like music where it's like, yeah, I can see how you have all the sounds arranged in a particular way, but where's the music? It's like, well, the music comes for free, just like, you know, breakfast comes for free or the party comes for free. Mm-hmm. So if consciousness is like that, then, you know, there shouldn't be a hard problem. Like I should be able to just describe the brain states and it's just like obvious that like, oh, well, that entails that there are phenomenal properties, mm-hmm. but it doesn't. And I think it just can't.
Why? Know, so,
well, I mean, so why not? Well, I mean, there are some arguments to that effect. I mean, this is sort of where we get into not just like the statement of the hard problem, but like the knowledge argument, okay. where you've got like Mary in this black and white room, or you can say she's colorblind or something. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, she's the world's greatest neuroscientist She knows everything there is to know about neuroscience, but
she's never seen the color red.
Yeah. And then she learns something when she sees the color red. And, you know, prima facie, it seems like, well, that means that there's something that physical science can't tell you about consciousness, you know, what it's like to see red.
Why doesn't that just tell you that without exposure to a specific set of stimuli, you don't have the experience of that stimuli?
Well, it does tell you that as well.
Yeah.
Because everyone talks about Mary, like there's this other character who's like, I think in the same paper, but I haven't read it in a long time, but there's another guy named Fred. So like Fred, it seems like he claims to be able to see a color that we can't see. Mm-hmm. And like, we come up with some clever tests and it seems as though he really is seeing something that we're not seeing.
Okay.
And so the question is just like, how much neuroscience do we have to do until we know what it's like to see whatever Fred is seeing? And it's like, well, I'm never going to know what it's like to see that color. But that seems to indicate that there's something over and above. I mean, like if you just turn strictly to natural science to explain what it's like to see whatever color that is, you know, in other words, to explain phenomenal consciousness, it just seems like it's just the wrong tool for the job. Like I'm never going to know what color Fred is seeing. I can do all the neuroscience I want for my whole life. I'm never going to know what that.
Well, you know, so when you say no, you mean you'll never experience the same experience.
Yeah, I'll never know what it's like just by learning about physical science. So that seems to indicate that physical science is not telling me what it's like to see that color.
So here's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. So the objection is that physical science can't somehow transmit to anybody an experience. Like, so even if we can explain multiple facets, almost all the facets of how a thought functions, unless and until physical science can make experience transmissible, then it can't explain anything, or so it's not a sufficient explanation?
No, that's definitely not the argument. Like some people...
Keep in mind, moron.
No. Sean Carroll's not a moron, and he seemed to think this was the argument too, but okay. It was like in his debate he just had with Philip Goff, but it's like the idea is not that doing neuroscience will somehow cause you to have the experience. Like you're just reading a textbook and you're like, oh, that's what it's like. The point is just that the knowledge given to you by neuroscience is not sufficient for you to know what it's like. And I mean, that just seems obvious. And there are different ways around. I mean, like, again, a lot of physicalists will grant, yeah, of course, Mary learned something. Or of course, like if I had the experience Fred was having, I would learn something. But they try to argue that's not really a threat to physicalism. But the point here is just to illustrate the epistemic gap, you know, the same thing just with, you know, describing the hard problem, you know, or I kind of like conceivability arguments, you know, zombies and ghosts and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the point, at least at this stage in the argument, is like, just to illustrate like that phenomenal properties don't logically supervene on brain states. And it seems like they should, if all these analogies that people always give are right. You know, like you gave...
When you say logically supervene on brain states, can you explain that to me like the moron that I am?
Because like it just comes for free, you know, like there's just no way to, like in the same way, there's no way to describe the component parts of the flower when they stand in a particular relation to each other. It's like, oh, but where's the flower? It's like the flower just comes for free as soon as you describe its underlying parts in the right relation. So the flower logically supervenes on its parts in structure. But phenomenal properties don't seem to, you know, with brains.
Okay. So I think I'm stuck on the experience thing. Like me and Sean Carroll apparently are like this because mm-hmm. Because it seems to me as though like a counterpoint to that argument would be like, if you could create the set of circumstances that led to that experience, you could not only elicit that experience in another person in an almost identical fashion, if all things held constant, but you could predict that that would be the experience. You couldn't experience it. Maybe you couldn't find the words to articulate it because you've never had the experience and there's no one else that has had the shared experience. So you would have like a linguistic like hindrance in the ability to do that. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that it's not necessarily replicable, or is that like a silly objection and I'm getting caught up on something?
Oh, I mean,
it isn't relevant.
I think that your like reading too much into the argument, basically. Like you're
that is my brand.
Thinking that, like you're thinking like the argument is trying to prove more than it is maybe trying to, or that at least I'm trying to.
I'm not even thinking that it's trying to prove more. I'm wanting desperately to find something that does explain it.
Oh well, too bad. I'm sorry.
Sucks to be me. Sucks to be everyone on earth who actually gives a shit about this, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's I guess maybe I should have mentioned that sooner. Like I don't claim to have like the explanation of consciousness. I don't think anybody has the explanation for consciousness. I think we have very odd oh yeah, yeah,
I'm sure if you're aware.
Yeah, Eric Hernandez does, but nobody
he
does else.
It. He nailed it. Yeah.
I mean, I think we have like super broad conceptual schemes that mm-hmm. we call like, you know, we have super broad, basically uninformative metaphysical theories. Mm-hmm. And we say like physicalism or dualism. And like these are sort of like different paradigms, like different, you know, theories, different hypotheses, but like none of them are like really, really specific.
Yeah.
They're like very, I mean, like neuroscience is going to do like, I can't even imagine what we're going to learn in the next like 20,000 years, assuming we still exist and everything. But like, you know, we might not even be able to like imagine what the answer will be.
Yeah.
Like, I know that you interviewed Mark Salms about the Hidden Spring.
I've got that book on the shelf behind me. I loved that book.
You know who else really loves him is Thomas Nagel, which is somewhat surprising to me. Yeah, like the... Yeah, the
good book. Have you read the fucking Hidden Spring? It's a really good book.
I've read like a paper that Mark Salms wrote that like summarized what he thought were the key points in this thing called the Journal of Consciousness Studies.
Yeah.
And I read like Thomas Nagel respond to it. And I just heard Thomas Nagel give a talk. And for those who don't remember, he's the What Is It Like to Be a Bat Guy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's weird because, and by the way, he's an atheist and a non-physicalist. Like,
oh, I mean, I don't care what somebody's position is if they make good points.
It's just worth mentioning that, like, you know, because, well, anyway, we can come back to that in a second. Yeah. But yeah, he said something about like, oh, Mark Salms is on the right track, which I found kind of like surprising because Nagel gives the impression of someone who would like not be happy with anything. But he seems to like Mark Salms a lot. And, like, what really,
you should. So you've not read The Hidden Spring?
Just the summary thing that
you should really read The Hidden Spring. It made me think, as somebody who's studied the brain for a really, really long time and is fascinated with brains. And like, that's the paradigm that I think through. So mm-hmm. like, that's the framework that I'm working with. And when I'm engaging in philosophical conversations, I'm thinking about neurochemistry and neuroanatomy. And I'm going, a lot of this doesn't make sense. And he brought up like functionally, like super like base level. And if you've read like the summary, like his proposal is that consciousness is kind of grounded at like the foundation of it is like emotion. Like mm-hmm. emotion is the necessary baseline, and then consciousness is built upon it. And then he talks a lot about like the reticular formation and different components of the brainstem and people who are encephalitic and gauging their reactions and how like you would still see that as consciousness. And we typically conceptualize consciousness more so as like complex thought and less so as like the baseline of like experience and emotion, which would be like from a reflexive standpoint, like even in all creatures, like having like an emotional experience is like a survival mechanism. So that would be the baseline, and then consciousness and then broader conceptualizations of like thought are built up on top of that. And I thought, wow, that's like a really, like from a neuroscience perspective, that's a very parsimonious and like it makes sense like as a theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love his idea about affect being kind of like mm-hmm. the foundational starting point, you know, like that should be sort of the like the main tool yeah. that we're using. I'm really sympathetic to that basic idea. He doesn't like panpsychism very much, and I think that's because well, join the club.
You're in a small corner. You're right. Philip Joff just by yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's pronounced Goff, by the way.
Goff. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's just because Mark Salms, like when you talk about that idea of affect as like, you know, kind of like the center of consciousness and the thing that other things are built out of, mm-hmm. you can't help but, I mean, at least for me, you can't help but like immediately go to like this panpsychist interpretation where all causation is mental causation, and like affect kind of explains not just mental causation, but like causation in general. And like that has been something that's been defended by like Hedda Hasselmerck, who defends this thing called the phenomenal powers view. But it's a really good, you know, kind of way of systematizing causation like across the natural world. But I did want to return to something you said, because you mentioned like interaction and kind of like neuroscience and stuff, how it all fits together. So, you know, I just don't think that we're in a position to really explain consciousness at this point in history. Like, we can kind of have informed guesses, you know, and like we can make arguments that maybe like lead us in, like, I still think we should try to figure it out, you know. Like, I think
which is why conversations like this and other conversations surrounding it are like super important.
Yeah, like, I don't think that Mark Solms would exist in his current form were it not for, you know, Thomas Nagel and other philosophers of mind who were talking about this. Like, maybe it was important in the causal history of him even developing his theories. But I mean, we should be mindful of like the limitations of neuroscience, like in at least in the present day.
Well, even in his book, he says at the end of it that it's just a hint. Mm-hmm. That's how he describes the book itself. Like the entire book, he sees it as just a hint.
Yeah, I mean, he continues to like impress me. He seems more like, you know, philosophically inclined than a lot of people who are like, you know, writing informed things about neuroscience. It seems like there are a lot of people who are like really, really good at neuroscience, and then they're just like awful when it comes to philosophy, or they're like really good at philosophy and they don't know that much about neuroscience. And whenever you find these like unicorns who like are kind of good at both, it's kind of cool. Like, you know, David Chalmers is pretty informed about physical science and neuroscience. And he's also like, you know, the preeminent non-physicalist, also an atheist, by the way. But anyway, something I was going to mention is that
one for us.
actually, most of the prominent non-physicalists, but fMRI, you know, which everyone like loses their minds over brain scans. fMRI is like super low resolution. Like, I think every pixel corresponds to like 4.5 or 5.5 million neurons. I mean, like, when you think about it, that's like a crazy, low resolution. And like, you know, I just mean like our tools are extremely blunt. And like, even if you are super optimistic about neuroscience figuring everything out, which I think there are good reasons to doubt in the first place, well, even if you do think neuroscience is going to figure it all out all on its own, well, you know, it's not going to do it anytime soon.
I don't think that neuroscience is going to figure everything out, but I feel like the more neuroscience uncovers, the more difficult it is for me to adhere to some of the posits that I've been exposed to, if that makes sense. So, like, we can start talking about panpsychism. Like, so for panpsychism, let me give you my layman's super uninformed, like, I've read Philip Goff's book, and my friend John Steingard was really interested in panpsychism as well, and I've had chats with him about it, like, not online but just in general, and I've listened to like you talk about it because I followed your work for a long time.
Love John, by the way.
Yeah, he's like just the best human. Like, he's so cool and like very smart, super fucking sharp guy. Like,
really. I have a picture of him signing my shirt from when I was like 12.
No way.
Yeah, because
you like Hawk Nelson, eh?
I did, yeah. I saw them like probably like four or five times, but I was like that was at something called the baseball tour where they were like but yeah, it was like after the show, I'm like 12. I have like a buzz cut, and like John Steingard and Jason Dunn are like reaching over and like signing my red shirt. I have the picture, but I'm trying to find the shirt. But yeah, if I ever talk to John Steingard on the podcast, I'm going to pull that shit.
He'd love that. He's a super cool guy. Yeah. But like, yeah, he's interested in panpsychism. So I've had conversations with him about it. And I find it really difficult. I feel like it's a big song and dance around a huge problem, because, and you can correct me, like, you can like set me back on the right track, because it seems as though, like, at its base, it's saying that every piece of material, like down to the most finite quantum level, has some form of rudimentary consciousness, right? Like, like, material itself has consciousness as like a built-in component. to its existence. So I'm on the right track so far. Like that seems so where I get caught up is what is it about its configuration then that would lead to me being conscious, but this star that I've been fiddling with that fell off my ceiling isn't conscious. Like I don't have any moral obligation towards this. Like I could snap it in half, I could stomp on it, like I would feel nothing about it, and I would be justified in feeling nothing about doing that because I don't, this isn't conscious. So there needs to be something that happens between what configured this into its current instantiation and what configured me and you into our current instantiations. And that seems like the more important question to me. Like, what is it about this that makes, even if it is true, it doesn't answer the important question to me.
What's the important question?
Is like, why is this configuration conscious and this is not? Like, this doesn't have experiences. Like, if I throw this against the wall, people aren't going to go, but if somebody came in here and punched me in the face, people would have a reaction, obviously, right? Because we know that there is something that it is like to be me. I don't think that there is something that it is like to be this.
Right. Well, sorry to put my annoying vegan hat on for a second, but everyone pretty much agrees that animals are conscious and people act like they have no moral obligations to animals. Like people pay others to have them tortured to death on a regular basis. So, it's like something to be a cow and a pig.
I agree with you on that.
And like people treat them horribly already.
Yeah, but I think that that's deflecting from the point that I make is that like
people,
this is an inanimate object we all agree doesn't have consciousness. I do agree with you on that. I do agree with you that animal, but it's a plant. Like, where do we draw the line? Like, it also makes the line kind of a sliding scale that like doesn't have any clear distinction, because the plant that you're sitting next to, would we say that that's conscious? Like, we demonstrably would say that it's living. So where do we draw the line and why do we draw the line? It doesn't seem to answer those questions to me, which seem like the important questions.
Well, so, I mean, this is what's called the combination problem. And it's like, you know, generally considered to be panpsychism's main problem. You know, like if you take a bunch, like if you take you and me and Paul and, you know, various Christian photographers and you like, and you stick all our heads together, like, it really doesn't matter how you put us together. Like there's never going to be like a macro mind that emerges from just squishing us together. It's like, oh, well, we just need to do some more science. We'll figure out how to stick these people together in the right way. And then we'll get a macroscopic consciousness out of it. So like, you know, how does that happen where we have all this like particle level consciousness, you know, and it arranges in the shape of a brain. And then suddenly I'm here, you know, this macroscopic subject.
I have a second objection too, by the way, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, sure. I have more objections to panpsychism too, but I think that, you know, so there are different ways of answering the combination problem. The least arbitrary way is just to say that the star that you throw is, it is like something to be that star.
Okay.
That's a minority position among panpsychists, but it is like kind of, I mean, if you really want to eliminate all arbitrary seeming boundaries and the stuff of the world.
So like the only reason we think that there isn't is because this can't communicate with me that there's something that it's like to be it. Like it doesn't have that ability. Yeah.
But like, you know, if you think about like language, obviously is not essential to consciousness. Like you can have conscious and no language, language and no consciousness, like ChatGPT or something. So, so I mean, like Luke Roloff's would be like, yeah, I mean, it is like something to be that star. It's not like a morally significant form of consciousness that you should be worried about, but you know, it is like something to be pretty much every configuration of matter. Most panpsychists don't take that route, but I mean, it is there. So the thing, like, that's like the maximally counterintuitive view that you could have. I mean, but it does eliminate arbitrariness. So a less counterintuitive view that is slightly more arbitrary involves something like, I mean, so like the most systematic answer would be like something in the form of integrated information theory, where they say like, well, you have to have maximal phi, and phi is this mathematically precise value. It's, you know, determined by these like five axioms or something. And then it's like, if you as a system have a higher degree of phi than, you know, any of the systems that you're a part of or of any of your parts, then that's the locus of consciousness.
Okay.
Pippa is saying consciousness without language. Possibly.
Possibly. Yeah. No, I was just putting it up on the screen.
I don't think animals really have language as we typically think of it.
Not as we think about it, like when we're talking about phonemes and morphemes, but they have forms of like self-produced noise that communicate information. So I would say that if you're drilling down language to its base form, then being able to create auditory information that transmits a message is a rudimentary form of language. Yeah. And animals do have that.
I mean, that's just not what we mean by language, though. Like,
why not?
Well, like if someone can kind of make noises, you know, if a human being is like otherwise nonverbal, but they can do what you just described, I would not say they have language. I would say maybe they have like a proto language or something, but
or
like,
form of communication. Let's distinguish the difference between language and communication then, because yeah, I think people using it interchangeably here. So when we're talking about language, we're talking about the construction of phonemes and morphemes into recognizable language sounds that have like an abstract representation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's fair. Like, so animals can communicate, but
yes,
they don't have language.
But I think that that's what she probably meant, or they probably meant. Sorry, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Pip is.
Well, I mean, it has been proposed like that there is this essential connection between language and consciousness. I just don't think it's plausible. I mean, very few people do, but like there have been philosophers who've been like, humans weren't conscious until they had language. Okay. I mean, I don't really buy that.
I think that's crazy.
It has been.
I think that's a bit bonkers. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to distract us from the conversation.
The star
nicely.
So, according to integrated information theory, the star is not conscious because it has parts that have a higher degree of phi than the star as a system. So, you know, you don't need to worry. And like according to IIT, the things that are conscious are basically organisms and things that are kind of basic, you know, so like particles and stuff like that. Well, I mean, it's actually ambiguous, but I mean, there are like panpsychist interpretations of IIT, but there are like very simple systems that are, that have maximal phi. And then other than that, it's pretty much just organisms. So yeah, I mean, like a lot of panpsychists are sympathetic to IIT and like that basically. So I mean, IIT actually does imply that like there's some sentience associated with plants and stuff. Okay. Yeah.
So my second objection, I'm super interested in hearing this, is that like, let's say I grant all that and I'm like, oh, okay, cool. That makes sense. The star potentially has a rudimentary form of consciousness. What the next thing I don't understand about panpsychism is if each individual component has a form of consciousness, each individual component of me and my star and my guitar and all the things, each like right down to the like quantum level has a form of consciousness, how does it unify into a singular experience as opposed to being billions and trillions and quadrillions of individual experiences? And what is to prevent me when I touch this wall from now integrating with the consciousness of this wall, since I as a physical property am now interacting with this wall and my hands have consciousness because they are made of physical stuff and so does this wall? What is to prevent that integration from taking place if not for the fact that the only part of me that generates consciousness is my brain?
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of another statement of the combination problem. But when people say the combination problem,
okay,
it's like there could be
so it's a broader like, problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like there are a few different problems that people could be talking about. Mm-hmm. So like technically both of these problems would fall under the broad umbrella of the combination problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a priori, it just seems weird. Like this is what I was trying to get at with like the squishing our heads together and like it'll just seemingly never happen. Like,
why aren't we collectively now one unit? Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like IIT gives like a principled answer to why, you know, you and the wall don't become conscious, or like why mm-hmm. you and me and a bunch of other, or like a football team isn't conscious. Mm-hmm. So I think there are like non-ad hoc answers to this that have been, you know, explored, you know, and like even in the realm of neuroscience. But like, I mean, I grant that like a priori, it seems totally bizarre that like you could get a bunch of little subjects and put them together and they would like unify to make a macro subject. Like the borders would kind of dissolve and then now there's a macro subject. So yeah, I mean, I also have that intuition, but I also think that, you know, intuitions need to be kind of brought into equilibrium with other intellectual.
Well, what does it answer for you that you would feel willing to sacrifice that as an intuition that you feel like it's the, like the, there's a payoff?
Yeah. No, for me, the payoff of panpsychism is all the payoffs of physicalism, you know, and there's no hard problem. So like, that's why I like panpsychism. It's like, it's a form of monism where there's only the physical world and the physical world has like an inner nature. So like, there's still just the physical world. It's just this one physical substance, but there are kind of two sides to the same coin. And, you know, I think it has other benefits as well, like arguably environmental benefits and like spiritual benefits, but those are just kind of happy, you know, add-ons. But I mean, really, if you think about, well, why be a physicalist? And you think about the motivations for physicalism, all of those apply equally to panpsychism, where it's like, hey, there's this pretty striking correlation between like the human brain and human consciousness. You know, I mean, doesn't that, isn't that at least some evidence that there's only one thing there, you know, the brain? And it's like, okay, yes, but it's kind of weird that there's this epistemic gap between phenomenal properties and physical things like the brain. So is there any way that we can have it so, you know, we don't have to violate, for example, the causal closure of the physical, like when you were describing earlier, you're describing like, you know, sodium ions and like neuronal activity and like in detail, you know, step by step by step. And you're like, okay, where is the mental causation? Like, where is the phenomenal consciousness stepping in and doing something?
Yeah. Where's the interaction saying like moving these things around that we know need to take place?
And the advantage of panpsychism is saying like, oh no, that is like, that's all that's there. It's just, that stuff from the inside is experiential. So you don't have to add something else in. It's just when you're looking at brain activity, that is just what consciousness looks like from the outside. So when you look at me, you don't see phenomenal properties. You just see physical structure and behavior. And
but isn't there still something special about the brain in that paradigm?
Yes. Yeah. Because human consciousness.
What is it?
Well, I mean, it's whatever physicalists would say. It's like. I mean, it's not different. It's like, that's
well,
why
I would
like
say no, I would say I don't know. And well, if that still leaves a problem for me, I would say I have no fucking idea.
Like, well, there's obviously something special about the brain, right? Like the brain allows us to have this extraordinary form of consciousness that like doesn't exist in cats. It doesn't exist. Even if we grant that, like, yeah, sure, like plants are conscious, electrons are conscious, why not? It's like, okay, but that doesn't change that human consciousness
currently imbibing conscious material. Yeah,
exactly. You're drinking consciousness. And it's just like, okay, so the whole world is made of mind stuff. Okay, that doesn't change the fact that human consciousness is this amazing, exceedingly rare form of consciousness that only exists because of our brains and bodies. Because remember, there's no division to be formed here. It's just complicated physical processes are going to be complicated conscious processes from the inside, and simple physical processes are going to be extremely simple forms of consciousness. You know, there's no downward limit on how simple consciousness can get, you know. So it's just, there's going to be this perfect correlation between the complexity of physical activity and the complexity of the corresponding mental activity.
I like the idea of it, and I'll tell you why I like the idea of it, even though I still can't buy into it. I like the idea of it because I don't like any of the outside-in perspectives. I think that they all sound bonkers to me. Like, they just sound crazy. Like, they seem like they're positing so much extra crap just to retain potentially, like, some other belief or whatever, that they don't seem like they could even make sense as hard as you might try. But I agree that there's a hard problem. Like, I'll 100% admit that. Like, the fact that there is something that foundationally and fundamentally isn't any different than my ceiling star that fell down, that generates an experience, that's like something's going on, and that's something that's fascinating. Like, there's no reason that this doesn't have experiences and I do, except for there clearly fucking is, because I am having experiences. And as far as I can tell, this isn't. Mm-hmm. Right. So that is a problem.
What would it look like if it were? I mean, like, what would it look like if the plant, if it was like something to be like, if this is just like a weird guy?
It could be like something like, and that would have crazy moral implications that would be interesting to explore. Like, it could be the fact that it is like something to be literally any physical.
Yeah, why not? I mean, the universe is weird as fuck. Like, I mean, it wouldn't really be like, I mean, why would we expect the world to be like not weird as fuck? Like, I mean, it's almost like it would be more surprising if it were like totally it mundane.
Crazy. Yeah, I mean, I get that.
And I mean, we're conscious. We're physical systems that are conscious. And it's like, yeah, I mean, the hard part, if you're a physicalist or sympathetic to it, it's like the hard part's already over. You already think that physical systems can be conscious. Like, it can be like something to be a bunch of physical activity. And it's like, well, yeah. And you're kind of already are there. I mean, you're halfway there already for panpsychism.
I don't think I'll ever get all the way to panpsychism, though, because like everything about me could remain constant, but I could scoop out my brain, like all the way down to the brainstem. And then I am demonstrably not anymore. Like, you could carefully cut this open and meticulously, like not even violently, like cut me off at the brain stem, extract my brain. I'm demonstrably fucking done. Like, whatever experiences I was having stop being had. Yeah. There's no more electrical impulses. There's no more blood. Like, there's no more neurotransmitters firing. There is nothing happening, which means to me that those things are a necessary component to consciousness, not just being physical.
I mean, they might
like,
just
at
be
least
necessary
phenomenologically, like as it comes to like me having the experience, which is the problem. The problem is I'm having an experience that I can articulate. So I don't know how that solves the problem, because I can say, well, if I don't have a brain, then there is no experience for me to articulate, even if the rest of me is intact and is made of physical stuff. Mm-hmm. So doesn't that retain the problem?
Well, I mean,
because there's a special configuration that is required to answer it in that paradigm.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, panpsychists wouldn't have trouble, at least I don't think, with that sort of problem of like you not existing anymore. Because okay. It's like, well, look, you are this particular, you know, physical, mental entity. And it's like, you
but
are...
if I chopped my arm off, they wouldn't have that problem.
Yeah, you would still be you. But it's like, I mean, obviously, there's something important about the brain.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you get rid of your brain, then you just don't exist anymore. That's not a problem for panpsychism. It's like,
really?
You
Why?
Were this... What
I
do you
was
mean,
the brain.
Why?
Well, because panpsychism, if I'm... Maybe I'm thinking of it too broadly, is that... everything has a component of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, consciousness would still exist. It's just, it would like disintegrate into its component parts,
but
and you wouldn't exist anymore.
So there's something about the brain within panpsychism that is special.
Well, no, it's, well, yeah. I mean, yes and no. It's like, you are.
Harrison, fuck. What do you mean like, yes and no?
Well, it's not that the brain like generates consciousness. It's just that
it's necessary
your
for
consciousness. Well, it's necessary for your consciousness. So, I mean, if you want to exist, this particular configuration of thoughts and beliefs and desires and all the things that constitute you, then that, you know, basic physical pattern that's like, you know, on the screen right now, that has to exist. And if that pattern is broken, then you don't exist and a bunch of other stuff will start to exist.
That
consciousness is just
that
always
made of components of me.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like the physical stuff is still going to be there too. Like, it's not like if I, you know, oh, where did all the physical stuff go? It's like, well, it's just going to scatter it around.
Right. You know? And now it's going to reconfigure potentially in the consciousness of like another person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is like panpsychists answer a lot of the same questions. Or they answer questions in the same way as physicalists, like almost across the board. Like on panpsychism, it is very unlikely that there's an afterlife, you know, because I mean, once the physical structure stops existing, you stop existing and then other stuff starts existing.
So like panpsychs, they would at least have to admit that they don't answer the question of why the experience of being me or you or anybody in particular or anything in particular, like, is unified and unique?
I mean, panpsychism is just a really broad metaphysical position just about the intrinsic nature of matter. It doesn't really set out to answer like super specific questions, just like saying, oh, consciousness is physical. Okay, well, that doesn't answer most of the questions you might have about consciousness. It's just a very broad metaphysical position. Like, you know, physicalism is oh, consciousness is physical. Okay, well, I mean, that doesn't really answer anything specific, but it's not supposed to.
Okay.
It's just like a paradigm you can operate on.
So like really panpsychism is just saying consciousness or like you me having unique experience is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a supernatural experience. We need to explain it somehow. And we explain it by saying that every component part of you, no matter how finite, has the property of being conscious built into it, like baked into it. But we can't explain how there needs to be a unique configuration with a specific set of circumstances in order for it to elicit you having an experience that is unique and is you. We can't explain that, but it's a step towards explaining that.
If I understand what you're asking, it's like, I mean, there is a very general answer to that, which is like, Okay. Well, look, I mean, the particular configuration of, I mean, like you and I are like very similar because we're both human beings, you know, like all the physical processes that exist in the universe, we have way more in common than we don't. But like, The reason I'm having this exact experience that I'm having right now, according to panpsychism, you know, it just comes down to the arrangement of matter, like in my body and in this room. And like, if you change the arrangement of matter, then you're going to change the experience because Okay. Those are just the same thing from different perspectives, which is, you know, basically the same answer that the physicalist gives. They just kind of restrict, you know, they say, well, at some point there's this line where physical material, it becomes like something to be physical material, and panpsychists just don't draw that line.
Okay. All right, I think I understand it a little bit better, but I'm not sure I have any less objections. We're actually starting to get super chat. So if it's okay with you, I'll put it up on the screen.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Coffee Breath. If I perfectly digitize my brain and the digital brain, is the digital brain me? Or is there something unique about the wetware version of me? Interesting question.
I mean, this is, I think, one of the better arguments for substance dualism, actually, is just concerns about personal identity. So like, if you think about, you know, the ship of Theseus, where you like remove one plank of wood and like one bit of the ship, you know, and eventually it's all replaced. And then, you know, the structure is still there. It's the same structure, but it's all different component parts. Is that the same ship? Well, like a really easy way to solve the problem is like, if the ship had a soul and it had the same soul, then it would be the same ship. But as soon as you remove the soul, that's when it's like, oh, I don't know. Is it the same ship? Like, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe there's no fact of the matter. Maybe it's just a convention. So like, I think that if you digitize your brain, there's a sense in which the digital brain is you, but it might not be a sense that you should really care about, you know? So like, I don't think that you can kind of upload your consciousness to like, you know, the cloud or something, and then you will survive. I just think there will essentially be a clone of you that survives, but your point of view is still going to come to an end. And then there's going to be this other point of view that starts that has all the same memories as you and the same beliefs. So like, I mean, in a sense that is you. Like, think about a perfect clone of you. In a sense that is you, okay? But in a very important sense, it is not you. So, I mean, that's kind of the answer that I tend to land on is like, you know, you can make a copy of you, you can make a clone of you, and in pretty much in every sense, you know, it's qualitatively identical to you, but like, it's obviously not you. You know, you're not going to avoid death by uploading your mind to the cloud or something. So I don't know if that answers the question, but
I don't know. I feel like it would potentially identify as you.
You would think it was
all things being held equal, but would deviate because now you're creating a track where it's accumulating different experiences.
Yeah.
which is a huge component of self, is experience.
Mm-hmm.
And how you incorporate that into your sense of self. Like, most of your sense of self has to do with how you've interacted with the people you know and your environment. So if you create a circumstance under which you're now interacting differently, or at least exposed differently, then I think that that is now a new unique entity. I don't think it's you anymore.
Would you get in the teletransporter?
Oh, like a Star Trek transporter? Yeah. Absolutely. Even if it kills me every time. 100%. Because I wouldn't know the difference. Are you kidding? I am a massive Trekkie. Like, super, uber, psychotic. Like, I'm even going to watch Discovery when it comes back. I haven't watched a lot of Lower Decks, admittedly. But I've watched every episode of every iteration of Star Trek. All of the movies. Lunatic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'd get in it. 100%. You wouldn't?
It's a murder machine. No, I mean, like,
who cares?
I'm terrified of death. That's why I don't want to get in.
But, like the doctor on Next Generation. What was her name? The one who replaced Dr. Crusher. Zelensky? I can't remember her name. She hated the transporters. So did McCoy. She wouldn't get in it because she called them death traps. She said they take you down to the molecular level and then reconstitute you and make you, like, they basically kill you and then reconfigure you.
Yeah, no, they absolutely
do a similar constitution.
I mean, like, I think that you die, like, your point of view that you're experiencing right now, that comes to an end. And then there's a point of view that starts up that is not yours, you know, like it's someone else's who's qualitatively identical to you.
Wouldn't care. I'm gone. Don't know the difference. Fuck it. Star Trek. Yes. If it's indistinguishable to me, why do I care?
You're dead. There's something, there's someone else who thinks that they're you who is now alive.
And that person's me now. So I don't care.
But here's the thing. Let's say you get in the transporter and it malfunctions, and then the new copy of you is constituted over there. And then they turn to you and they're like, oh, we're shit, you're still here. And they're just like, oh, so the transporter, it's screwed up, but you're still going to die in 5 minutes. So don't worry about it. You're on the planet over there. And you're like, no, I'm not. I'm right here.
Just a risk assessment that, like, that's just a cost benefit analysis that you're proposing to me now. You're just saying, so if you told me, like, explicitly, I'm going to get on this transporter. We're not talking about the consciousness anymore because fuck that. Like, so you tell me explicitly, I'm going to get on this transporter and I'm going to die, but I'm going to, like, be, like, reconstituted in a manner that, like, it's indistinguishable to me from not dying. And I'm just going to carry on. I'm going to go, okay.
Are they the same atoms?
They couldn't be.
Okay, well, then I'm not getting in it. I mean, like...
Why? You think it's going to fundamentally change something about you?
In the sense that I...
Because you're a panpsychist. Those aren't my consciousness atoms. Those are different consciousness atoms.
Those are different consciousness atoms. Those are not mine. I mean, like, there's going to be a guy who fully believes that he's me. And again, he'll be qualitatively identical to me. But just as soon as I realized that, like... So you get in the transporter and it, like, vaporizes you, but, like, I mean, there's no difference between that happening 5 minutes later and that happening at the moment you press the button or whatever. But I feel like in those 5 minutes, it would be very clear to you that, like, that's a clone of me. That is not me. And, like, this thing is about to, you know, vaporize me.
What if it's instantaneous? Like, why are you giving it 5 minutes? Like, you're giving yourself time to second guess it and realize that you're dying.
I feel like you need to call the suicide hotline or something, because this is clearly, I mean, like...
No, I just want to go to different planets. That's all I want. I just want to go see Rigel 7. Don't begrudge me that, Emerson. You don't get to judge me.
I will say, maybe if I was, like, more certain that panpsychism was true... And they're like, look, it's all the same atoms. We beam them over there. It's all the same atoms. They're in the same structural configuration.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be like, okay, I'll get in the transporter. But those are the conditions.
But you wouldn't.
I would. If it's the same atoms and I was pretty much convinced that panpsychism was true, then I would do it.
Well, I mean, you can't... they could physically... dissolve the atom. So how do you feel about, like, you've grown up, you were a baby at one point, I assume. Mm-hmm. You didn't just manifest out of like thin air into reality.
Yeah.
So you've cycled through a lot of atoms in your life already.
Right.
Right. Like, you're not constituted currently of what you were constructed of initially.
Yeah.
Like, that's just absolutely the case. So how is that functionally different? Like, if it happens instantaneously as opposed to over time, there's a substantive difference.
This is why I said this is actually, it seems to me like it's a good argument for substance dualism, because I feel like I am the same
how
person.
How dare you? Not
like, I mean, because you're right. Like, if I hold to that consistently, then it's like I die all the time. Like, I'm like, you know, like it equivalent, like I am equivalently going through the transporter like every 7 years or whatever it is.
And like, components of you are joining other things. And like,
yeah. So it's like, if I'm, you know, really, if I'm a consistent physicalist or consistent panpsychist, then like I should have no problem with the transporter. And I should accept that, like, if you upload, you know, if you upload me to the cloud and then there's some like chat bot that says all the things that I would say, then it, as long as it has like a point of view and it's subjective, then I should grant like, no, that is me. But the thing is, that seems wrong. It seems like it's not me. And when I look at myself from when I was like 10, or like that photo where John Steingart is signing my shirt, it's like, I am, that's me, you know, like that's the same guy. And yeah, the only
you have theory, continuity.
Yeah. And like the only theory that can really fully accommodate continuity over all these physical changes, you have to say that, well, the I, like the personal identity, that's non-physical, and like that's this like immaterial soul, because the physical stuff all changes.
But why can't it be that the physical construction of the brain allows for you to store memories in nodes? Like, have you ever, there's a really good book called The Jennifer Aniston Neuron. You should read it. And I know the title is probably off-putting, but the title exists for a reason. It's because they discovered that there was a neuron like that would consistently fire when they exposed somebody to pictures of, or the concept of Jennifer Aniston. Like, they were able to measure it. They were able to measure the neuronal node. Like, as you said, fMRI machines can't like look finite down to the microscopic level, because they're going, it's magnetic resonance imaging. They're not going to be able to go through the skull like a microscope can. But it consistently activated, and they were able to see it like using like dye packs. And even though the brain constitution changes over time, that area was consistently activating, which indicates that there's a storage area for things like memories within the physical brain. So what makes you you is an important question here, because what makes you you is your memories and how you interact with them, how you perceive them, and how you integrate them into your sense of self, right? Like, your experiences build your sense of self. So if your brain is able to store those, why would it not be that, like, as one little tiny atom sheaths off and another one replaces it, that the function of the system itself is retained, and the system itself is what's important?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I can conceive of someone with all the same memories that I have and the experiences that I've had and like the causal history I've had. But like, it's obviously not me. Like, if you just told me like, hey, you have an identical twin, by the way, like, you know, and like
if I put you in a transporter and it like manifested you here, then reconstituted you here, and now there's two of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, I mean, like, one of those is me and the other one is not me. It's like a copy of me. So like, I just don't think that you're nothing over and above your memories. Like, you are, you must be something over and above, you know, some of the qualitative characteristics.
No, I agree with that. I'm just saying, like, there's clearly a system that's more than its component parts that is important. And I don't think you need to go to the atomic level to explain it, I guess. I guess I'm not thinking straight about it. Like, I love talking about this stuff, but sometimes I talk about it and I'm like, where am I? I'm so far in the weeds right now. Like, we've been talking about transporters.
Well, I mean, it's philosophy of mind. It's you know, personal identity. But you know, I mean, I do like interactionist dualism way more than you do. Like, I don't think it's crazy.
Why do you like dualism interaction? Explain it to me like I'm five, because I don't get it. Like, I feel the interaction problem seems like such a huge obstacle. And also it seems like you're multiplying entities, because you're saying, well, the explanation is there's something in the ether that is me, that it's like, that's my body, and goes and gets it.
Yeah, I think
that seems crazy.
So, I mean, first off, I guess, like, sometimes when I defend dualism, people will be like, oh, this is like religious residue. You know, this is like, you know, your Christian upbringing. You just haven't fully let go of it or something. And it's like, well, look, most humans who have ever existed have been dualists. Like, there's strong evidence from this, from psychology and also anthropological evidence.
So
that, like, well, it's just worth saying, because people think that I only am sympathetic.
They've also been Christians probably too. Like, so,
well, not farther back than a couple thousand years, but I'm saying the point I'm trying to make is just like,
fair. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just trying to say that, like, you can't tell me that dualism is just the product of my religious upbringing or religion, because dualism existed for way before monotheism, let alone like Christianity. So it's like the default
and
setting.
All things are worth interacting with and taking seriously until the point that you can walk away from them.
I mean, so like, it's the default setting for human beings. It's not like it's just because of religious indoctrination or something like that, but it's also not a Western invention. It's not Descartes' fault that, you know, I mean, I'm all for blaming the French about all manner of things, but it's actually not
I'm Canadian. His fault. I can't allow for that. I'm sorry.
I mean, it's actually not his fault, but, you know, it's just totally ahistorical to say that, like, oh, well, you know, dualism, you only care about that because of Christianity or something. But anyway, I think there are like there even are some dualists who are atheists, and there are also dualists who are Christians, like Richard Swinburne, who say like Swinburne says, like, well, I don't really care about the like biblical or like religious reasons to be a dualist. Well, not that he doesn't care. He's like, but I'm a dualist for like purely philosophical reasons. You know, like, I just think the arguments are better. And like Michael Humer, who you mentioned earlier, who I interviewed.
I love that conversation.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, there are, I've also been listening to this guy named Ralph Stefan Weir. He's a Christian too, but he's a substance dualist. He's just a really interesting philosopher. But yeah, I mean, I just think that the interaction problem is just like not really a problem. Like, I don't really get what it's even supposed to be, because
what?
I think that, you know, physical stuff and mental stuff, like, can you conceive of these two different types of substances interacting? It's like, yeah, I mean, like, what's the problem? Like, what exactly is the issue with two different kinds of things just being causally, there's a reliable set of causal connections between these two substances. What's the issue?
I'm gonna need to process that for a second. So you don't. Okay. How do I articulate this effectively? So I talked to you about sodium potassium ion transmission, right? So you understand that that is the case. Like, you would agree with me. Like, you'll take me at least at face value that I'm not just making that up. Like, you could look it up.
I don't think you're making it up. I think
you could advocate for your own understanding, and you could go look up papers and look up neuroscience, and you could see that it is the case that in order to create the electrical impulse, in order to get the action potential required for a neuron to fire, that is the case. Like, there needs to be a specific concentration on either side of a cell membrane. It needs to reach a threshold. That's all a physical process, right? You agree with me on that?
Well, I mean, I don't think we know exactly why things happen all the time. Like, we can see reliably that the whole process you described step by step, it's like, well, look, we can see that, you know, A happens and then B happens and then C happens and then D happens. But like, it's not clear what the nature of causation is. Like, it's not clear. Like,
I agree with that. Like, it's not clear what the nature of causation is. But like, so I feel like I wish I had beans and like a so let's say this lip gloss that I happen to have here is a neuronal membrane, and this pen that I have here is a sodium ion, and my star is back and it's a potassium ion. This is going to be super rudimentary. So it needs to in order for the neuron to fire, this and this need to switch places on either side of the cell membrane physically, right? Okay. And in order to do that, there needs to be a certain amount of stars here. or they were over here. There needs to be a certain amount of stars over here, and there needs to be a certain amount of pens over here to reach that threshold. Like, they are physical, actual material things that exist. And then once they do reach that threshold, they can't go before, they can't go over. They need to reach a specific threshold, and then the mitochondria in here needs to produce ATP, open the pathway, and then they go back and forth. So
I hope this gets clipped of you just like explaining
this is my lip gloss, a pen, and a star. Where's the pen even from? It's actually, that's funny. I got this at a conference. It says religion, science, and reality on it. I don't know if
it's just like teaching philosopher neuroscience
with a pen, a star, and a lip gloss.
It goes through, and then it's like, and I'm just like.
So, like, well, I just wanted to demonstrate that they're physical things. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can talk as much as you want about causation, but that, like, physically is the case. So, if my lip gloss is here, my star is here, and there's no pen.
Okay.
There's no pen.
There's no pen.
How does this neuron fire?
I mean, I guess it doesn't. But I mean, the idea, though, is just that, like, the mind.
So how does the pen get here?
I mean, the idea is just that the mind can causally impact what happens in the brain. And the brain.
So the mind manifests a potassium ion.
Well, I mean, this is why I brought up the broader question of causation, because if there's a reliable set of causal connections between physical events in the brain and mental events, so like the physical events can make a difference to the mental events and the mental events can make a difference to the physical events, then, I mean, we're going to see the same kind of data from neuroscience, like whether or not like that's the case, because it's not clear always like what's so causing what.
So the mental events can influence the physical events. What I'm hearing is my lip gloss is here. There's a star here.
Yes.
This is my sodium ion inside the cell membrane. And there's been a mental event. And then just poof, potassium ion appears out of nowhere.
Well, no, I mean, what?
Just is manifested into existence.
Well, isn't this
so that
that's,
they
that,
can the swap back and forth?
The stuff that's in the brain is already there. It's just like the way things happen.
So it's down here, and then it goes something moves it up here.
Okay.
Like, I don't understand why that makes sense.
I mean, look, I think that physical causation is mysterious enough that when you really see how weird it is that causation exists at all. And then you say, but what about mental to physical causation? It's like, that seems just as weird as physical to physical causation to me.
But it's not even just that it's weird. It's just that it would require like the movement of physical objects, like granted at a microscopic level, or the manifestation of physical objects. Like they would need to be created, like just poof into existence, or they would have to physically change location.
Yeah, I mean, but physical.
And you're saying, well, I don't see why that's a problem.
Well,
I mean, that seems like a fucking problem.
Physical causation is super weird, though. Like, if you think about people who were objecting to Newtonian mechanics, like, they were saying, like, okay, the sun is like 93 million miles away and it's having an influence here, but like, it's not touching the earth, it's not touching anything.
So, your counterpoint is that weird stuff has happened in the past, so it's entirely plausible. This sodium ion's here and this potassium ion's way down here, and then something happens with the external version of me that is the soul that needs to interact with my brain, and it just gets it up here. And like at this is just one neuron too. It needs to do that billions of times every instant.
I mean,
for that to make sense.
The argument isn't just like, well, weird stuff. It's like, well, look, people thought causation used to work this particular way. It seems like you're kind of implicitly assuming like the soul has to reach in and like touch that stuff and like move it over there.
It literally would have to in order for
but
a neuron
not,
to fire.
That's not even how physical causation works, is what I'm saying.
What are you saying? How are you saying physical causation works? Now I'm just using my neurons. I've lost my lip. Neuronal membrane shine on my lip.
I mean, what I'm saying is like, no one thinks that even physical causation has to happen through physical touching and pushing like they did around the time of Descartes. And that's why there was this big interaction problem, because they had this particular view of causation where it's like you have to like reach out and like, you know, contact mechanically push the stuff around. And that's why I brought up Newtonian mechanics, because like that was the first
quantumly, maybe like,
well, just like what I'm trying to say, that physical causation is already radically counterintuitive, where like,
I need this super clarified for me, because this is like a linchpin for me. So are you saying, I'm going to bring up my very shiny, neuronal membrane and my sodium ion. My potassium ion's down here. It's not here yet. So this, like, no action potential. Nothing can happen with this neuron right now. So what you're saying is that there is a state of affairs that I'm just, that's not available to me, or I'm not considering, or I'm not completely comprehending, where this can either move or manifest to this position. And I'm like, am I silly for thinking that doesn't seem plausible? Like, you're saying that it can, like, something will poof it here, or something will create it here in order for this to happen. Because the only other alternative to me seems to be that you're saying that swap doesn't need to happen. Which is a denial of how neurons work.
I mean, I'm not denying how neurons work. I'm okay. Just saying that I think it's possible that there's a substance that, just like physical substance influences physical substance, you know, that's a very general statement, but it's like, okay, I think that a different kind of substance could influence physical substance. And I don't think there's anything weird exactly about just some kind of reliable set of causal connections between the mind and the body.
Is there a limitation to it though? Like, so this is where I get caught up, because I'm super like, so let's say like, there's sodium and potassium ions throughout the brain. So you're functionally saying like something could interact and be like, I need this neuron to fire. So it's super smart too, because it's saying this particular neuron amongst others needs to fire. So because this is over here and that's not where I need it, I can shift it over here, and I can do that on a mass scale.
Well, so that this, I mean, to translate, when I think that you want to raise your left arm,
right,
your left arm goes up. I mean, that's what I think is happening. I think that like you have a conscious intention to do something.
Okay.
And then your body does it as a consequence. And then like neuroscience can reveal all kinds of crazy shit about like how that happens. But like, it is ultimately like an empirical study of like what happens in the physical body. But I just don't think that rules out that like there could be a non-physical soul or, you know, mind, and there could, you know, they could make a difference to one another, the physical brain and the mind. Because I think ultimately it is pretty implausible to deny that like your conscious deliberation plays a role in things, like, you know, your decisions and your thoughts and your feelings, like those have causal efficacy. So I mean, that's the part that I would sooner accept that there's some kind of mysterious causal relationship before I would deny the causal efficacy of my own mind.
Interesting. Okay. That's an interesting statement.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that like when I avoid pain, it's like because I want to avoid pain and because pain is painful, you know, like that's a pretty high on the list of things that I'm sure about, you know, like my mental states have causal efficacy. So if that commits me to saying like, yeah, I mean, there's interaction, there's like, you know, there's causation between these different concrete entities, you know, the soul and the body. It's like, I don't know. When I really reflect on the nature of physical causation, I'm like, I mean, the universe is already weird enough. And it's like, oh, but you know, mental to physical causation, oh, I can't even imagine such a thing. I'm like, I don't know, man. I'm already pretty weirded out by physical to physical causation. It just doesn't seem like there's a huge gap in like implausibility or weirdness or counterintuitiveness.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I'll marinate on that. I will marinate on it instead of just, I feel like my star needs a break. Literally the star of this show. Okay, fair enough. Like, I feel like I have additional objections to dualism.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, I mean, what I said earlier, I won't keep you too long. We've already been an hour and a half, but it seems strange to me that there is some sort of extant configuration that is me, that just finds me somehow. And it's like, this is going to, I'm going to be me in this body.
Yeah. I remember I asked Michael Humer that. I'm just like, why does my soul connect to my body? And he was like, I don't know.
Fuck knows. What a stupid question. And like, why is it your soul? Like, what substrate does it exist within that it, is it just waiting for any baby to be born? And like, is there a competition? Like a baby's born or like a baby is conceived and it's like, that one's mine. Like have, how many of them just like die off due to miscarriage? Like all of that seems silly to me.
Yeah. I mean, he thinks that there are these souls that kind of exist like, and the soul is not made of parts, you know, it can't really be destroyed. So it's like your soul does like, you know, start interacting with your body at some point. And and when I asked like, okay, why does this soul interact with that body? He's like, well, I mean, if you remember at the very beginning of this conversation, it's like, well, consciousness is private, like phenomenal consciousness is not like open to empirical observation, like from the outside. So that makes like pretty much any question involving phenomenal consciousness, like exceptionally difficult to investigate. So if you are like already convinced of substance dualism and someone asks a question like the one I asked, then it's like, well, I can't like observe the behavior of souls and be like, oh, well, have you noticed these patterns in the way that the souls like behave? It's like, you just can't do that. But I mean, even if you, I mean, on, like I said, I'm not like a committed substance dualist or anything. I just don't think that it's like as implausible as most atheists do. But I still think that regardless, phenomenal consciousness is private. So regardless of whether you're a physicalist or panpsychist or dualist, you just like it, empirical investigation of consciousness is exceedingly difficult because of the privacy of phenomenal consciousness. So it's hard.
It's a problem in most of psychology because in order, like, it needs to be self-report.
Yeah.
Which and is there's inherent issues with self-report.
Yeah.
And there's no way around it.
Yeah. It honestly sucks because it's like, you have to rely on self-report. But like, if we could just observe where consciousness existed and where it didn't, then like there would be no issue of like panpsychism or physical. We would know where it existed. And then it would just be a question of like how to explain why it pairs up with these systems and not others or something like that. But we don't even know where it exists and where it doesn't exist because it's private. It's not publicly observable. I have to infer that you're conscious. I can't even observe, you know, your phenomenal properties.
What's up for debate? Depends on what you Google. I'm not even a person, according to most people.
Yeah, the names that you change, like on Twitter, like I can't understand.
Have you seen my new Twitter profile? It's Hater on a Grader because somebody literally made that picture. Not somebody who likes me, but I took it because it's me. So fuck him. I'll do whatever I want. It's a picture of me on a grader.
I honestly, like, people say extremely rude things to me, but like I see the things people say to you and I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, how do they feel comfortable? And sometimes it's like their full legal
name. I'm not
sure
if you're aware, but I'm a woman.
Oh, okay.
So sometimes people interact with me differently in this realm than they do with other people. And I'm saying that solely because I'm an extreme feminist woke person. And that's the only reason I'm saying it, not because it's my lived experience. And that's just how it is if you're a woman on the internet, especially if you want to engage in any sort of intellectual dialogue.
Are women treated differently on the internet?
I would say maybe. Okay. Not entirely certain, but also like so far I just turn it into like empowerment. Like it doesn't impact my position like or like perception of myself even one iota when some moron on the internet writes an article about how they feel like I dyed my hair to get attention. I just changed my Twitter handle and say thanks for proving you're a fucking moron. Have a nice day.
Yeah. I mean, it is funny that you appropriate all those names and stuff, but.
Oh, yeah. They could bite me.
Yeah.
Take the power away from them.
I mean, I would actually advise you not to become a panpsychist because people feel like they have license to just be incredibly rude to you if you're a panpsychist. So I think the woman panpsychist combo is going to...
Or I was like ready made for this. Like I was born for this. I have been training. I was like, this is what we play for. Maybe one day I'll be a panpsychist. Because I'm like, what are you going to do? Tell me I'm stupid? Yeah. You're going to tell me I'm ugly? What are you going to do? All right. Well, that's a good place. Me calling myself stupid is a good place to end the stream. For anybody who tuned in late, why don't you tell them who you are and where they can find you if they want to hear more about not just philosophy of mind, but philosophy in general and engage in like really great intellectual dialogues and exploration.
Thank you for that. Yeah. I have a channel. It's called Emerson Green. I have a podcast called Counter Apologetics, where I talk about philosophy of religion. And I have a podcast called Walden Pod, where I talk about basically all non-religious topics. Like the one we talked about today is pretty much a non-religious topic. But yeah, I mean, if atheists agree with, I mean, I'm assuming most of the audience doesn't agree with me about most of the things I've been saying about consciousness, but still, I think you should agree with me that you can think these things as an atheist, and just don't let apologists tell you that you have to have this or that view. You know, you have to be a reductive physicalist if you're like an intellectually honest atheist or something like that. Like, as far as I can tell, there's little to no connection between, like, you know, whether or not you take a position on God's existence and, you know, whether or not you think phenomenal properties can be explained totally in terms of physical properties or not. It's just not really connected. So I don't know, just don't let apologists, you know, tell you what you can or can't think. So yeah, thanks for having me on. I had a great time.
I'm stoked that you're here, and I love the message of not letting apologists pigeonhole you into perspectives, because what they say is apparently what all of us think. So thank you very much. And please go check out Emerson. His link is in the description to his channel. Go there and find him all the other places. And as always, everybody, help elevate the discourse. Bye.